Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer portion of today's conference. To ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn your conference over to Ms. Monica Allen. Ms., you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining this media call today. Again, I'm Monica Allen with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating today's call. Today, you will hear from four federal scientists who will discuss two major assessment reports being released by the U.S. Global Change Research Program. The first is the legislatively mandated National Climate Assessment Volume 2 on impacts, risks, and adaptation in the United States. It's available, as many of you know, online right now at nca2018.globalchange.gov. Volume 1 of the fourth National Climate Assessment, which is also called the Climate Science Special Report, was released last November. In addition to the Global Change Research Program, the Global Change Research Program is releasing the second State of the Carbon Cycle report, also available online right now at carbon2018.globalchange.gov. After the call, questions relating to the process, timing, or administration positions on either report should be directed to Dr. Michael Cooperberg, who is the Executive Director of the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And here is his email, M. Cooperberg, that's spelled M-K-U-P-E-R-B-E-R-G at usgcrp.gov. And for all inquiries related to the findings of the National Climate Assessment, please direct those to me at my email, which is monica.allen, or M-O-N-I-C-A dot A-L-L-E-N at N-O-A-A dot G-O-V. And now, I will turn this over to our first presenter, who is Dr. Virginia Burkett, who is the acting chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. Dr. Burkett will provide an overview of the U.S. Global Change Research Program and the legislative context for introducing, and then she will introduce our three speakers to talk in detail about the reports. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Monica. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Virginia Burkett, and I'm speaking today in my capacity as acting chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research, which oversees the U.S. Global Change Research Program. We call it the USGCRP, but the research program basically began as a presidential initiative in 1989 and was codified into law by the Global Change Research Act of 1990. The program is charged by its founding legislation to, quote, assist the nation and the world to understand, assess, predict, and respond to human-induced and natural processes of global change. The USGCRP has four major sets of responsibilities under the mandate of the law. Number one is to coordinate research needs and investments across the federal government with an emphasis on the 13 agencies named in that 1990 legislation. Number two is to inform decisions by working to translate the basic science produced by the research program into forms and locations that are accessible to a wide variety of audiences across the nation. Our third responsibility is to export that knowledge, data, and tools developed by the United States to the international community with an emphasis on developing nations. And finally, we are charged with delivering three products. Number one, an annual report to Congress on the progress of the research program. Number two, a decadal research plan or strategic plan that has triennial updates. And number three, a quadrennial assessment of the state of understanding of climate change with a focus on the United States. Today, I'm pleased to announce the delivery of Volume 2 of the fourth edition of the National Climate Assessment, or NCA 4. As Monica mentioned, we released Volume 1 last fall. It was more of a physical climate science report, and it did provide a foundation for the development of Volume 2. So NCA 4, in its across the two volumes, is an authoritative, comprehensive assessment of what we know about observed and projected global change, as well as the impacts this change has on American society. The release of NCA 4 today marks the first time in history of our program that the USGCRP has delivered a quadrennial assessment in the mandated four-year time frame. In addition to the release of NCA 4, you will also hear about a special report produced by the USGCRP on carbon cycling. We refer to it as SOCR 2, but the official name is Second State of the Carbon Cycle Report. So we'll start this afternoon by describing the assessment and who wrote it and how it was produced, followed by some broad key messages from the NCA 4 Volume 2. Now I'd like to turn the press call over to Dr. David Reed-Miller, Director of the National Climate Assessment. Dave has shepherded the fourth National Climate Assessment from beginning to end. He will summarize the process by which the USGCRP produced the assessment, which is the most comprehensive to date. So, Dave, I'll turn it over to you now.
Thank you, Virginia. Good afternoon. My name is Dave Reed-Miller, and I am the Director of the National Climate Assessment at the U.S. Global Change Research Program. As Virginia noted, today we're releasing Volume 2 of the fourth National Climate Assessment, Impacts, Risks, and Adaptation in the United States at nca2018.globalchange.gov. Volume 1 of NCA 4, the Climate Science Special Report, was released in November of 2017 and is available at science2017.globalchange.gov. Together, these two volumes fulfill the congressional mandate for a quadrennial assessment. As you may all be aware, there are two major international climate-related conferences taking place in early December: the UNFCCC Conference of the Parties and the American Geophysical Union's Fall Meeting. We anticipate the NCA being a topic of conversation at both of these. As such, we wanted to get the NCA out into the public sufficiently in advance of those meetings to ensure the community had time to review them. I'm very excited to release this report today after 2.5 years of hard work by many, many people. I'm going to take some time to describe the NCA 4 development process, which was designed to produce a policy-relevant but not policy-prescriptive report of the highest quality that will serve as an authoritative source of information on climate-related risks to the United States. This assessment was written by more than 300 authors representing a range of climate-related expertise, including individuals who are identified through a public nomination process. And while NCA 4 is a federal report, about 50% of our authors come from outside the federal government, from state, local, and tribal governments, academia, the NGO and think tank community, as well as the private sector. The public has had several opportunities to participate throughout the development process, including an extensive public engagement effort in early 2017. This included a series of regional engagement workshops, sector-specific public webinars, and a number of listening sessions, all of which informed each author team's chapter development. This was followed by a 90-day public comment period from late 2017 through early 2018. The primary objectives of these public engagement activities were to ensure, one, that the report's authors were aware of the latest available science, and two, more importantly, that the report reflected what Americans care about. The assessment includes 12 high-level summary findings, as well as a roughly 40-page overview that synthesizes the underlying 28 chapters, which include 18 national topic chapters. The bulk of the report is dedicated to 10 regional chapters in an effort to provide more localized information relevant to decision-making. In addition to the summary findings and overview, the full report is being released online in HTML form today, with several additional features available for download, including chapter-specific slide decks, each chapter's executive summary, and a roughly 200-page report in brief written both in English and Spanish, which we're really excited about. All chapters are framed around key messages that are supported by the underlying chapter text and by what we call traceable accounts, which give readers a window into the author team's deliberative process in arriving at their conclusions. Another unique aspect of this report is the extent of technical review it has gone through. In total, there were 8 rounds of review, both within and external to the government, which resulted in nearly 10,000 comments. These include the public review and comment period I already mentioned, as well as a detailed external peer review by a committee of experts convened by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Finally, I want to thank the staff here at USGCRP's National Coordination Office, the Technical Support Unit at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, and the hundreds of authors who volunteered countless hours to this effort. The report is a reflection of not only their assessment of the best available science, drawing on more than 5,500 unique references, but their ability to communicate their findings clearly to the American people. I'll now turn it over to Dr. David Easterling, who will shed some light on the report's main messages. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Good afternoon. My name is David Easterling, and I'm the director of NOAA's Technical Support Unit. In this role, I manage a team of professionals who have supported the development, editing, and production of the National Climate Assessment. And I'm also the federal lead on the climate science chapter. I'll speak briefly about some of the main highlights of the fourth National Climate Assessment, but I urge you to dig into this rich report, which has a lot of detail in 29 chapters, 5 appendices, spread over more than 1,000 pages. As you've already heard, the report was written by more than 300 authors. And before I go any further, I want to make one thing very clear. This report is purely the product of those authors, and there has been no external interference in its development. The assessment contains two synthesis components, the summary findings pull together common themes across sectors and regions into 12 societally relevant areas. Second is the overview, which Dave mentioned, which begins with the changes that we're observing in the Earth's climate before describing current and future risks posed by climate change to American society in three broad categories, the economy and infrastructure, natural environment, ecosystem services, and human health and well-being. This report is also an expanded regional focus, including a new chapter dedicated to the U.S. Caribbean region, and compared with past assessments, provides more details about climate impacts in terms of risk and economic costs. So let's start with a few findings about the climate system. Firstly, observations of global average temperature provide clear and compelling evidence the global average temperature is much higher and is rising more rapidly than anything modern civilization has experienced. And this warming trend can only be explained by human activities, especially emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Secondly, sea level continues to rise and will increase in the future, leading to increased risk in coastal regions. Extreme events such as heavy precipitation continue to increase and will increase in the future, leading to increased risk of flooding and other hazards. Earth's climate will continue to change over the century and beyond. After mid-century, how much the climate changes will depend primarily on global emissions of greenhouse gases and on the response of the Earth's climate system to this human-induced warming. So what about current and future risks? Climate change presents growing challenges to the economy and our nation's infrastructure. The natural environment and services ecosystems provide to society and human health and quality of life. Risks posed by climate variability and change vary by region and by sector and by the vulnerability of people experiencing impacts. Many extreme weather and climate-related events are expected to become more frequent and more intense in a warmer world, creating greater risks of infrastructure disruption and failure that can cascade across economic sectors. Regional economies and industries that depend on natural resources and favorable climate conditions, such as agriculture, tourism, and fisheries, are increasingly vulnerable to impacts driven by climate change. Some aspects of our economy may see slight improvements in a modestly warmer world. However, the continued warming that is projected to occur without significant reductions in global greenhouse gas emissions is expected to cause substantial net damage to the U.S. economy, especially in the absence of increased adaptation efforts. Climate change also threatens many benefits that the natural environment provides to society, such as safe and reliable water supplies, clean air, protection from flooding and erosion, and the use of natural resources for economic, recreational, and subsistence activities. Valued aspects of regional heritage and quality of life tied to the natural environment, wildlife, and outdoor recreation will change with the climate. And as a result, future generations can expect to experience and interact with natural systems in ways that are much different than today. Without significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, extinctions and transformative impacts on some ecosystems cannot be avoided, with varying impacts on the economic, recreational, and subsistence activities they support. Higher temperatures, increased air quality risks, more frequent and intense extreme weather and climate-related events, increases in coastal flooding, disruption of ecosystem services, and other changes increasingly threaten the health and well-being of the American people. Risks are often highest for those that are already vulnerable, including low-income communities, some communities of color, children, and the elderly. Future climate change is expected to further disrupt many areas of life, exacerbating existing challenges and revealing new risks to health, including mental health and prosperity. So how do we address the risks of climate change? Many climate change impacts and economic damages in the United States can be substantially reduced through global scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, complemented by regional and local adaptation efforts. Since the third National Climate Assessment came out in 2014, a growing number of states, cities, and businesses have pursued or expanded upon initiatives aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Also, the scale of adaptation implementation across the country has increased. However, in closing, these efforts did not yet approach a scale needed to avoid substantial damages to the economy, the environment, and human health expected over the coming decades. Thanks, and I'd now like to turn this over to Bill Hohenstein from the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Dave. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Hohenstein. I serve as the Director of the Office of Energy and Environmental Policy at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I also serve as USDA's representative to the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. In addition to the congressionally mandated National Climate Assessment, the U.S. Global Change Research Program periodically produces special reports on topics that represent emerging societal needs or that have substantial advancement in scientific understanding. We are releasing one of these assessments on the topic of carbon cycling, called the State of the Carbon Cycle Report. This is the second of these reports prepared, focusing on advances in the science and the presentation of new data that have become available since the release of the first report in 2007, hence the name SOCR2. SOCR2 provides an up-to-date assessment of our scientific knowledge of the North American carbon cycle. This comprehensive report addresses North American carbon fluxes, sources and sinks across atmospheric, aquatic, and terrestrial systems, as well as relevant perspective from scientific observations and modeling, decision support, carbon management, and the social sciences. The report presents key findings and actionable information on observed status and trends within the North American carbon cycle. The carbon cycle encompasses the flow, storage, and transformation of carbon compounds that are central to life and to the production of food, fiber, and energy. Carbon also helps regulate the Earth's climate, including temperature, weather events, and more. Let me focus on some key findings. Since the release of SOCR1, concentrations of atmospheric CO2 and methane have continued to rise. From 2007 to 2015, the global rate of increase in CO2 averaged 2 parts per million per year, and methane concentrations rose by an average of 3.8 parts per billion per year. In North America, greenhouse gases are emitted primarily from the combustion of fossil fuels, cement production, organic matter decomposition, land use change, and agricultural activities. North American emissions from fossil fuel combustions are the most significant source, and these emissions have declined by an average of 1% per year over the last decade. Evidence suggests that North American lands have persisted as a net sink over the last decade, taking up about 600 to 700 teragrams of carbon, which is the equivalent of 11 to 13% of global carbon removal by terrestrial ecosystems. Inland waters serve as both a source and a sink of carbon, emitting more from sources such as the decomposition of organic matter than are being stored in sediments. Most analyses of the atmospheric carbon data, which are included in the report, suggest that the North American methane emissions are relatively stable. The report also includes carbon management, technologies and practices, including tools and options in the energy sector, land use, forestry, and agriculture. And finally, the report documents improvements in our ability to understand the carbon cycle and attribute observed changes in the North American carbon budget to specific causes. While SACRA 2 is a technical report, it includes a plain language summary that's intended for a diverse audience that includes scientists, students, and reporters such as yourselves. Like the NCA 4, SACRA 2 does not recommend or evaluate policy, but it is intended to help inform decisions, policies, and actions across the United States. SACRA 2 can be read at carbon2018.globalchange.gov. I, too, would like to thank the authors and contributors to this report. There were over 200 experts who helped in preparing the report, serving as lead authors, contributing authors, reviewers, and review editors. Thanks. I'm now going to turn things back to Monica for the Q&A.
Thank you, Bill. We'll go to the operator to direct the reporters who have questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, and you will be prompted to record your first, your last name, and your company name as well. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. One moment, please, for our first question. Our first question comes from Scott Waldman with Energy and Environment News. Sir, your line is open.
Thanks for taking my call. Can you give a sense of who exactly will be most at risk from these climate dangers you've indicated here? And also, can you explain why this was released on Friday after Thanksgiving and not at the AGU conference as it appeared to be originally unveiled?
We're going to, Scott, take those questions separately. Dave, Reed Miller from USGCRP, can you handle the second question? And Dave Easterling from NOAA, can you handle the first question?
Yeah, this is Dave Easterling. So my understanding of the question is who exactly is at risk or most at risk?
Yes.
Well, I mean, that would be people that are currently vulnerable. There are a lot of areas around the country that are vulnerable in different ways, but it would be a lot of people that are in underserved areas, you know, people in coastal regions, people in areas that are prone to flooding. There are a lot of different types of people that are going to be at risk.
Thanks, Dave Easterling. And the second question from Scott Waldman about the timing issue, we'll go to David Reed Miller from USGCRP.
Sure. Thanks for the question, Scott. As I mentioned, there are two major international conferences coming up where we thought the NCA would probably be a topic of discussion, and we wanted to get this out sufficiently in advance of those meetings to ensure that folks have a chance to review it. But I do want to emphasize that while I think your questions about the timing are certainly relevant, we hope you will focus on the contents of the report, which outline in clear, stark terms the risks America faces as a result of climate change. This is the most comprehensive and authoritative scientific assessment on climate-related risks that are confronting our communities, economy, infrastructure, agriculture, public health, and our quality of life. And we think the report speaks for itself. Thanks.
Our next question comes from Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I have two also, and my first one follows up on Scott's second one where you were talking, Dave Reed-Miller. I understand that other federal agencies and scientists wanted this out next week when it would not be the Friday after Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. and it would be before both AGU and COP. Was this a White House decision to make it Friday after Thanksgiving, and did it overrule, and this is one question, and did it overrule the federal agencies? And the second question is that this study several times contradicts what President Trump has said and tweeted as late as yesterday and Wednesday. It's like it's cold out, can there be global warming? And in section in chapter two, you contradict it. You contradict his claims on forest management and wildfires and on cyclical nature of climate change. Since this is coming out from the White House, which are we to believe is the White House's stance? The science here that's reported, or the president? And can you address why there's contradictions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Seth, for your questions. So the question of concerning what the White House, we ask that you email that to Dr. Michael Kupperberg, MKUPERBERG at usgcrp.gov. As far as the timing, I believe that Dr. Reed Miller was pretty clear that about what the why the timing was done the way it was done, and that we really ask you to focus on the substance of the report, which is so important to the American public. If you want to add to that, Dr. Reed Miller, please feel free.
No, I think you covered it sufficiently. Thanks, Monica.
We'll take another question.
Our next question comes from Mark Slufstein with Times Picayune, New Orleans. One moment.
Hi, folks. So obviously I'm a local reporter, and I'm going to be asking the local question, which is I'm in South Louisiana. The state's doing quite a bit to deal with coastal restoration in the context of its potential for sea level rise. It's changed those reports. Its suggestions several times because of the potential for that higher level of sea rise to occur. Can you be a bit more specific about what Louisiana, and I'll let you just do the southeastern area, I guess, Louisiana and Miami, especially since those seem to be the hot spots often quoted by people, in terms of what kinds of risk will we be facing? Is it just the climate change, or is it also the intense heat days, the overnight heats, and more increased rainfall events? Am I getting all those right? And vectors?
So this is Dave Easterling. You pretty much you hit most of the increased risk. I mean, you're going to be seeing, you know, heavier rainfall events as you've been seeing in the past, increases in hot days, probably decreases in the colder days, sea level rise. You're going to have all the issues related to sea level rise. You mentioned Miami. Miami's already experiencing an increase of what we call nuisance flooding, or sunny day flooding, where at a high tide you start flooding some of the streets because of the sea level rise. So there are all those factors, you know, are going to be factored not only in Louisiana but also in the other parts of the Southeast.
Greater detail, Mark, can be found in the report in the section on the Southeast. And if you need more folks to talk with, just get in touch with me, and I will get you more information about that. But you can also see a list of the authors of the Southeast regional report as well, right in the report.
Yes, and also, Monica, also there's a Chapter 8 is on coastal effects, and there's a beautiful set of slides directly from the chapter with the key messages that address some of the issues that Mr. Schlesing just mentioned.
Thanks, Dr. Burkett.
Our next question comes from Robinson Meyer with the Atlantic Magazine. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much. I understand the effort to focus on the content of the report and the content is really remarkable. On the timing question, there's something I want to get a sense of, which is when was the decision made to release the report? today on Black Friday this afternoon. I've talked to a number of authors who said that they learned that it was coming out at an earlier date than AGU. I mean, of course, I understand the need to get it out before AGU, but a number of authors said that that decision was only kind of broadcast to them at earliest a week ago, and many of them only found out it was coming out today, earlier this week. So when was the decision made to get it out before, not at AGU, but before AGU and on this day specifically? And where did that decision come from? Thank you so much.
Again, I ask you on the call to take advantage of the time that this call has for you to ask questions about the substance of the report, which is extremely important report for the American public. The timing issue, we've covered the timing issue. The decision was made in the last week or so, but it's not as significant as what is in the report. So please direct your questions to the content of the report. You have four federal scientists to answer questions about those. We'll take another question.
Yes, our next question comes from Tom Costello with NBC News. Your line is open.
Folks, I understand your reluctance to answer that question, but it is a legitimate question coming from the news agencies of the country. And the concern is, of course, that there is an effort to tamp down this report, and that it's not coming from us. It would be coming from the administration. So I'll reiterate the question, and you have not answered it appropriately or fully. When specifically did you decide to release the report today during Black Friday? And second of all, are you fighting an uphill battle with this administration to deal with what you believe is a dire emergency facing the United States?
I'm going to restate what I said, that this call has the great advantage of having four federal scientists who worked on these two reports. And the substance of the report is what their expertise is. In terms of timing and all of that, we've told you what we are aware of in terms of the decision to come out today, which is that it was to get in front of these two major meetings and to have time for those folks who are going to those meetings to review this, and also because it was done early. So please, I ask you to focus on the content of the report, the substance.
Our next question comes from Brandon Miller with CNN. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. My question is for David Easterling. In your key messages, you mentioned something about it that we're at the warmest period since humans have been around, and that humans are the only ones that are responsible for this, or mainly through human activity is responsible for the warming. Can you just repeat that key message again? I want to make sure I get the quote correct. Thank you.
Sure. So the statement is, observations of global average temperature provide clear and compelling evidence that global average temperature is much higher and is rising more rapidly than anything modern civilization has experienced. And this warming trend can only be explained by human activities, especially emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So we're really talking about the modern era. I mean, humans have been around for, you know, thousands of years, but what we're talking about here are observations from observing stations around the world.
I'm not sure if my line is still open, but if so, can I follow up?
Go ahead and follow up.
Oh, great. So you're saying that it's just from the observations we know that go back, you know, just a couple hundred years, not back the full thousands of years that humans have been around? I just want to make sure I got it correct.
What we're talking about here is, yes, where we can actually attribute the rise in temperature to increasing greenhouse gases.
Thanks so much.
Our next question comes from Evan Bush with Seattle Times. Your line is open.
Hi there. Can you just talk a little bit about the greatest vulnerabilities to the Pacific Northwest? And I'll have a follow-up.
So
this is Dave Easterling. And
yes.
Dave, if you think it better to refer.
Yeah, I think it's probably better to go to the chapter authors for the Northwest, and Monica will have those authors for you.
Go ahead and send me an email. My email is monica.allen@noaa.gov, and I'll give you information on that and spokesman for those issues in that chapter.
Okay, could I follow up real quick?
Sure.
Just wondering about the hydrological shift in mountain areas and just what effects you're seeing in the report with snowpack and reduction of snowpack, and if you could just describe those a little bit more thoroughly.
So most of that was actually covered very nicely in the Climate Science Social Report that was released last year. And what we're seeing is reduction in snowpack and projected reductions in snowpack. Part of it is a reduction in the length of the snow season. But I'd refer you to the Climate Science Special Report, which is at science2017.globalchange.gov.
I guess more specifically, what are the effects that are concerning and outlined in this report of that snowpack reduction?
So in this report, it's all the issues that's associated with snowpack reduction. I mean, you have the snowpack, especially in the Cascades, is a major source of water for the Northwest, and so you're going to have issues there and the timing of snow melt and things like that.
Hey, Dave, this is Bill Hohenstein from USDA. If I might add to that question about the Pacific Northwest, that's an important region of the country for both forestry and agriculture. And so the components of climate change that affect both forestry and agriculture are going to be important within the region. That includes increases in the likelihood of drought and also changes in the hydrology due to changes in snowpack and how that affects water availability for both agriculture and forestry.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Abby Smith with Bloomberg Environment. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. You all mentioned a little bit earlier that the report really drills down into the impacts that individual U.S. regions will face. If you were talking to a state or a local policymaker, how would you recommend that they approach this report, particularly as they're looking at the impacts to their region and how they might mitigate or adapt to those?
Thanks. Let's take that out by Dave Easterling, please. And then others may want to join in.
Yeah, others may want to join in. This is Dave Easterling from NOAA. How they present this material. This material is, being used at the local level. Adaptation specialists are using it as they developed adaptation plans for their regions and their cities and things like that. So I'm not sure if anybody else has anything they can add.
Virginia or David Reed-Miller or Bill, would you like to add to that on how best to advise local folks to use this report?
This is Virginia. I would look at the regional chapter, and then, it'll have the vulnerabilities for the region and the observed trends and projections for the future. And then I would look back at the Climate Science Special Report where you can look at the changes in precipitation patterns for that region, changes in temperature, the physical changes. And then if there's a specific, like the question about coast came up earlier from Louisiana, then you would look back at both the southeast chapter and the coastal chapter and put them together. I would read both of those to develop context for adaptation in that particular area.
Yeah, and this is, again, Bill Hohenstein from USDA. So USDA maintains a network of 10 regional climate hubs, and those hubs contributed to these regional assessments and also are going to be using them. They're an excellent resource for states and local communities when it comes to building resilience within both the agriculture and the forest sector.
And this is Dave Reed-Miller. One thing I would just add is that if you look at the front matter of the report, it sort of lays the scene for how the framing of the report was developed. And one of the biggest aspects we tried to focus on was a risk-based framework and to think about asking your stakeholders in your region or in a given sector, what is it that you care about? And then thinking about how are those things that are important to folks in the region going to be affected by climate change? And then we also have some added features in the report that link to other federal resources like the Climate Resilience Toolkit, that's available at toolkit.climate.gov that helps local users as well.
Great, thank you.
Our next question comes from Alex Harris with Miami Herald. Your line is open.
Hi there. So digging down into the U.S. Caribbean part of the report, it seems like you guys point out some data constraints. Can you tell me a little bit more about what they are and what would be needed to bring the area up to speed with the kind of data collection we see in the continental U.S.? Thanks.
So this is Dave Easterling from NOAA. And if you're looking at, you know, sort of how long we've had observations in places like Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, it's just not that long, and there are just not that many observing stations down there. You know, the simple answer to the issue is to, you know, provide a little bit more in the way of observations. We're starting to be able to do that with observations from satellite and radar. But in terms of the historical context, we are limited by the number of stations we have down there. If we're going to look at long-term changes in temperature, we do have good long-term records of ocean surface temperature, sea surface temperature data. But we're constrained by the history of the observing systems down there.
Thanks, David. And Alex, please send me an email, and I will follow up with you on some of the folks who can help you with that specific chapter on the Caribbean.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Adam Rogers with Wired. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks a lot. So if timing's off the table to talk about, can you just tell me a little bit about messaging here? What you're saying in this report is it basically contradicts everything that the White House has been saying about climate change. Who are American people supposed to believe here, the White House's report or the White House?
I'd ask you to send me an email with that question, and send Michael Kupferberg an email with that question. Michael Kupferberg's email is mkupferberg at usgcrp.gov, and we'll handle that question there.
Well, let me follow it in a slightly to the converse then. As you say, there are four federal scientists on this call. Do any of you feel any frustration as to the way this report has been released? This represents 3 years of work. It's the work of hundreds of people, as you've all said. This is work that you've been directing. Obviously, you care a great deal about it. Do you feel like people are going to hear about it and respond to it the way you want them to?
Thank you for your question, and we hope you will focus on the contents of the report on this call and take advantage of the expertise on the call. This report has not been altered or revised in any way to reflect political considerations. It's out earlier than expected, and it is the most comprehensive scientific assessment of the risks and costs that will confront our communities, our economy, our infrastructure, our agriculture, our public health, and the quality of life for Americans. And please, that's the subject matter expertise that we have on the call today. We'll take another question.
One moment. Our next question comes from Peter Femright with San Francisco Chronicle. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, thanks. California, the report mentions California, the fires in California up to 2017, which I talked about how climate change impacted those and helped cause them. And it doesn't even include the largest and most deadly fire, which is still ongoing right now in Paradise. I'm wondering, what you think, whether this will continue, and what you hope this report will, the administration will do about this information.
Sure. This is Bill Hohenstein from USDA. Let me just start by summarizing what the report says about the links between fire and climate change. disturbances, including wildfires, have increased in recent years in terms of area affected, frequency of occurrence, and severity. And this has been influenced both by observed climate changes and human activities. Warmer and drier conditions over much of the western and southern U.S., paired with a century of fire exclusion and fire-prone areas, have contributed to a landscape with heavy flammable fuel loads. While many factors contribute to wildfires, including human-caused ignitions, a warm, dry climate has increased the area burned across the nation over the past 20 years. The recent California wildfires have occurred in chaparral and woodland-dominated vegetation, with some forests in higher elevations where vegetation can sustain high-intensity, fast-moving fires. High winds and high quantities of flammable fuels and ignitions contributed to these fires. The extended drought in the west has extended the fire season and area at risk. Specifically, drought may have contributed to the Camp Fire in Northern California, but was not likely to be a major factor in the fires in Southern California. Fire suppression in some areas of the west has caused more flammable material to build up and a higher density of vegetation. As the climate continues to warm, the U.S. can expect higher fire frequency with an increased length of the fire season.
And what would you hope from this, what you've found in this report, that the Trump administration would do about it, and also the other disasters that have been happening, hurricanes and flooding, and or are predicted to increase as well?
Sure. Well, there are tools and resources and approaches that can be applied at all levels to improve resilience. And again, you know, this includes, you know, understanding the factors which are contributing to fire risks, which include an expansion of the urban wildland interface, which has exacerbated the problem, and a lengthened the fire season. So, you know, part of the information in this report is understanding what these trends are and what's driving them, but also the tools and resources we have at our disposal to improve resilience of these systems, which includes managing this resource in light of the fire risk.
Does it hurt that the Trump administration denies that climate change even has a role in this?
No, I think we're basically focused on, you know, the work of this report, getting this report out there, and, you know, putting it into the hands of decision makers at all levels. There's a lot in this report that's going to be, you know, applied by the U.S. Forest Service and by our secretary and by folks up and down the chain, but also, you know, be used by folks in the state of California to really help manage the land and the resource base more actively and to reduce fire risks and to also understand where these risks are and what they're likely to be in the future.
We'll take another question.
Our next question comes from Robert Cheney with the Missoulian. Your line is open.
Hello, thank you. The regional chapters discuss scenarios, and I haven't had a chance to read backwards and find the technical explanation for the RCP 8.5, RCP 4.5. Can you describe the kinds of scenarios that you looked at that have different risk levels for things like snowfall and precipitation extreme events? And what are the forces or drivers involved that would lead to either a greater or a lesser scenario impact?
Yeah, this is David Easterling from NOAA. So we used what we're called representative concentration pathways, or RCPs, that basically are scenarios of how greenhouse gases might change through the 21st century. So we've tended to focus on two scenarios, RCP 4.5, which is sort of a lower greenhouse gas emission scenario, and the higher one, 8.5, which is sort of it's sort of akin to a business as usual. If you continue emitting greenhouse gases at the rate we currently are, sort of the way things would evolve through the 21st century. So if you're thinking about something like a risk-based framing, we would be looking more at the higher scenario where we wouldn't see much of a mitigation in greenhouse gases and how the climate would change and how risks would change through the 21st century. Then if emissions were reduced, then we would be looking at the risks associated with the lower scenario, the 4.5, and then we looked at things like changes in the number of days over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, changes in heavy precipitation events, and how they might vary.
And this is Dave Reed Miller. One other thing I would say, I would direct you to Appendix 3, Data Tools and Scenario Products, where we talk about some of the scenarios that were used in the report in a bit more detail, and I would just kind of highlight the fact that, you know, while greenhouse gas emissions are certainly the primary driver, there are a number of factors that can go into that, including technological innovation, population growth, and land use decisions. And so a number of agencies and other experts have pulled together to develop scenario products based on different types of population growth patterns, demographic shifts, urbanization, as well as kind of land use scenario projections as well.
If I can follow up, do those projections, are they specific to United States policy and activities, or are they dependent on international agreements or some other outside the U.S. activities regarding other people's greenhouse gas use?
If you're looking at climate model projections, those are based on sort of the international standard that's used to drive a global climate model that are set by the World Climate Research Program and used by the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Reports. The scenarios are global models, at least in terms of the climate models, are global models, and you know, we look at then how those global models simulate the climate of the U.S.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question, operator.
Yes, thank you. Our last question comes from Elizabeth Shogren with Reveal. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my call. I understand this assessment provides much more detail, more analysis of the economic impacts of climate change. Can you tell us a little bit about that, about how you came up with those that process of analyzing the economic impacts, and what are they now and what do you expect them to become? I don't know whether this would be for Mr. Reed Miller or who would be best to answer the question.
Sure, this is Dave Reed Miller. I can take an initial kind of attempt at that. If you in particular look at Chapter 29, the Reducing Risks Through Emissions Mitigation chapter, a lot of the economics aspects are summarized really well in there, and I would specifically direct you to some of the references that are contained therein to kind of dig into some of the work in a bit more detail. But a lot of what we looked at was based on some of the work in the climate impacts and risk analysis work, the CIRA work. Again, that's articulated quite a bit, not just in Chapter 29, but it has been customized and sprinkled throughout the report, throughout the regions, and throughout the sectors as well to really try and highlight that important but emerging area of research. And I think that's an important point to highlight as well, is that while this is a new aspect of the report, it's certainly an evolving area of study.
Why was it included in the report?
For a couple of reasons. I think, you know, one of the big objectives of the National Climate Assessment is to ensure we reflect not only the best available science, but the most relevant science. And I think from what we heard and during the extensive stakeholder engagement that we did and through the public review and National Academies review, there was a strong desire to see that kind of information in there. And so, you know, to their credit, agencies recognized that challenge and stepped up and you know, figured out how to incorporate it. And so I think it's an important and evolving area of research.
Thank you very much. That is going to conclude our call today, and I realize that there may be some additional questions. So if you have any questions about the report, please send them by email to monica.allen@noaa.gov. Again, that's monica.allen@noaa.gov. And any questions about the process, the timing, or administration positions on the report, please direct those by email to Dr. Michael Cooperberg, the Executive Director of the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And Michael's email is mcuperberg@usgcrp.gov. Thank you very much. That concludes our call.
Thank you for your participation. Speakers, please stand by.